Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. I've recently returned from a trip to Sri Lanka. And for those of you who aren't aware, I was ordained in Sri Lanka and I lived there and trained there for 10 years. Before spending a year in England and then coming back to Australia. And I haven't been back to Sri Lanka for 7 years, and I hadn't been back to visit many of the places where I lived when I was newly ordained for longer than that. And so it was a very lovely experience to be able to go back and meet some of the people who had supported me when I was newly ordained. I went to places where I'd lived 15 years ago and hadn't had contact with the people in those areas since that time. And one of the reasons I wanted to go back to visit them was because most of the people lived in the areas affected by the tsunami. But fortunately, although many of them lost their houses, there were few deaths amongst the people that I knew directly. There were deaths amongst their family members, but not amongst the people that I knew directly. Apart from going back to see how they had fared in the tsunami, I was also very keen to go back to tell them about what I'm doing here in Perth, to let them know that I was still a nun. Some of them, because I hadn't seen them since I left their village 15 years ago, had no idea whether I was still in robes. And they certainly had no idea what I was doing if I was still in robes. And so I wanted to let them share in the good fortune, the good karma that is happening here, because all of them, even if I haven't seen them for so many years, are a part of what's happening here. Because without their support in my early days, without the inspiration and their generosity, I may not have made it through to be here tonight, or to have come to Perth a few years ago, and to have been in the position to help to establish the nuns' monastery. I took back photos and I told them about the things that are happening here, and some of them couldn't believe that in a Western country there would be people who wanted to listen to the Dharma and people who had so much faith that they would come out to the monasteries every day and bring the alms food. In the village areas, of course, that's just very normal that they're amongst the nuns that go on alms round and that are supported by the people in those areas, supported with their food, their clothing, their medicine and their shelter to the best of the people's ability. But for them to hear about people in a non-Buddhist country being willing to offer that same kind of support, that was quite astounding for many of them. And to see pictures of our beautiful monasteries and of the city centre and the beautiful Buddha Rupa that we have here, that was really impressive for them. And I wanted them to be impressed so they could really rejoice in the good that's being done here, and that they could really appreciate what they've contributed to that by the fact that they supported me in my early days. When I first went to live in some of these areas, I was a very young nun, and I didn't know much about what nuns are supposed to know about. I've talked here before about how I didn't know the chants that children learn as soon as they're old enough to be carried to the temple. I couldn't do the chanting, I couldn't make the offerings in the right way, I couldn't speak the language. People were really astounded at how foolish I was. I didn't have any of those things at my fingertips. And still they supported me just because I was practicing as a monastic, and as they got to know me over time, they realised that I was sincere and doing the best that I could. And so I was always overwhelmed by their generosity and their faith and their willingness to take me on face value, even though I wasn't able to offer them a lot in the way of teaching. Fortunately, I lived with one other Sri Lankan nun who was a very skillful teacher of both the Dharma and meditation. And so because of her, I was able to participate in the life of a nun in the village, and gradually to learn more of what was expected of me, and to offer more to the people who were looking after us. And so over time, I established a very warm relationship with the people there. And so not only did I go back to tell them what I was doing here in Perth, but also to find out how their lives had unfolded in the time since I'd seen them. And it was lovely to go and be able to walk in the same village areas and meet people who'd supported us and hear what had happened to their children, for example. Some of the children were now parents and were showing off their own children. Many of the older people that I'd known had passed away just in the last few years because of old age. It was interesting to see that also some of the young ones had died, not just the old ones. Some of the young ones who I remembered and who I went to ask after had been killed in their late teens, early 20s, through accidents or through fighting in the war in the north. And so again, that was a very interesting thing to see, just the truth of the fact that there's no age limit on death. And although I expected some of the older ones not to be there, I was surprised when I found out that some of the young ones weren't there either. It was lovely to go to some places and for people to remember the time when we lived in the village, and to tell me that when we left that village, the people cried because they were sorry that we were leaving 15 years ago. And I had a nice experience. I went to one place where I'd lived for about 18 months, and during that time I made a trip back to Australia. And when I returned to the village, I took some very big wind chimes to make as an offering to the Bodhi tree there, because the Bodhi tree was the place in the village where people gathered to meditate together and to hear the Dharma. And so when I came back to the village, I took these wind chimes. And 15 years later, when I was coming up to this Bodhi tree area, I'd been invited to give a Dharma talk and some meditation instruction, and someone was going to translate for me, That was just recently. When I went back there, the people were very proud to show me that the wind chimes were still on the tree and that they'd managed to fish them out from wherever they'd ended up in the last 15 years and to hang them on the tree again and tell me how pleased they were that they had this reminder of the time that we'd lived in the village. So it was a very a joyful time to be back there, and they were, as I say, very happy to hear of what was being done here in Perth. And if I hadn't gone back, some of them wouldn't have known how they have contributed to the fact that we have this opportunity to practice the Buddha's teachings in this situation and to have the nuns' monastery. Apart from giving them the opportunity to rejoice in how they had contributed to what we have here today, I also wanted them to see how people here value the Dharma. Because very often when we grow up with something, when it's around us all the time, as it is for people living in a Buddhist culture, they can take it for granted. They assume that this teaching, which they've heard from the time they were very young, is just available everywhere and that everyone knows about it. And of course we know that's not the case. Many of us have searched far and wide to find some kind of teaching, some kind of explanation to life that answered our questions. Until we found the Dharma, we hadn't been able to find the answers we were looking for. And so very often when we've had to search for the teaching, we really appreciate it. We realise how wonderful it is and how special it is. But when it's always been there, sometimes we don't value it so much. And so I wanted to impress on the people that I met in Sri Lanka that they have something really worth looking after, really worth following, taking up and practicing. And I made the point to the people in the village, particularly when they saw the beautiful monastery and the lovely city centre that we have here, that I said to them, you might think that people in the West have got money to throw away because they're rich, and that's why they can build these monasteries and support these city centres. But I said to them, don't think like that. It may be true that the people in the West have more money than you have, but they could easily spend it on all sorts of other things, because there are all sorts of things they could buy for themselves, things that they could use their money for their own enjoyment. But they choose to use it to build the monasteries and to support the city centre because they really value the Dharma. They have faith and confidence in the truth of the teaching, and they're getting so much out of it. And that's why they're willing to support with such generosity. And of course it makes an impact when you realise that other people who haven't been born Buddhists but who've come to the Dharma have recognised its beauty, recognised its truth, and are taking it up seriously and using it as the guide's guide for their life. So these were the two points that I wanted to impress on the people there. First of all, that they had a part in all this because they have been one of the supporting conditions for my continuation as a nun, and the fact that I'm here today, and the fact that I'm here and that I was able to come to Perth was one of the conditions for the nuns' monastery starting. So without them, the nuns' monastery may not have started when it did and wouldn't have started with me. And also to impress on them that the Dharma which they have in their lives is really worth pursuing in earnest. Now, from my side, that was what I was hoping to share with the people in Sri Lanka who supported me. But one of the other things which comes back to my mind as a point of reflection, which is very important for all of us to reflect on here, is around the concept of continuity. Because as I look back on how it is that I happen to be here and what has developed here in Perth, I recognise that it didn't come from nothing. It has roots, it has beginnings way back in the past, not only the immediate past, but a long time back. If you think about it, it goes all the way back to the Buddha, and it involves countless beings from the time of the Buddha who've kept the teaching alive, who've kept the traditions alive, and who've made it possible for us today to practice in the same way that the Buddha practiced 2,600 years ago. And this idea of continuity, that what we have here comes from something, is really important for us to grasp, because just as the past gives rise to the present and what we have here, so the present creates the future. And what we do with what we've got right now is part of continuing the teaching, making the teaching available, and also growing in our own understanding of the teaching. When we're looking back at where we've come from and how we've gotten here, and we recognise that from the time of the Buddha, there have been countless beings who've made the teaching alive and made it available to us, we can also reflect that in past lives we may have been doing exactly what we're doing right now, that is, keeping the precepts, trying to understand the teaching, and cultivating the mind in meditation. So when we look back on those who've kept the teaching alive and brought it to this present, we may well have been one of those beings. This is part of the understanding of continuity and where we come from. The fact that we have an affinity with the Dharma in this life, the fact that we have an affinity with the people who come to the Buddhist centre, the people who go to the monasteries, the people who are living this kind of life with this spiritual emphasis. This again just doesn't come out of nowhere for each one of us. It comes because of the causes and conditions that we've created through the way that we've lived in the past. And again, this is very important for us if we're thinking about what kind of life we want for now and also for the future, not only for others but for ourselves, to see that where we've come to right now hasn't just come out of nothing and hasn't just come in this moment. It's part of the continuity of a process. This is something which, again, is very important, not only as we reflect on how we manage to be here practicing the Dharma, being open to the Dharma, but also as we look at the way our life is in general and what we've got in our life that we like and what we've got in our life that we don't like and we'd like to have otherwise. Because this process of continuity applies to the whole of our life. And if we want our life to be different from how it is now, then we need to look at where we've come from and how it's arisen in the way it is arising right now, so that we can see which factors, which causes, which conditions have been helpful and which ones haven't been, which ones we want to keep developing and which ones we need to let go of, to reduce and eliminate. This teaching, this is a fundamental teaching of the Buddha, that nothing arises out of nothing and nothing arises independently on its own. It always arises as the result of multiple causes and conditions. And looking back on how we get to be here now, how I got to be here now, this is my own personal journey and seeing the continuity from 15 years ago to here, right now. And even from the time that I've been in Perth, the continuity from when I first came here and to what's developed right here and now in my own personal practice and in my life in general. So when I'm looking at what I have in my own life right now, it makes quite an impact to revisit a place that I haven't had contact with for 15 years and to see that decisions I made back then are still playing themselves out right now. And this is the kind of reflection that we all need to wake up to, especially when we're contemplating what we don't like in our life right now. And I'm saying this not just in theory, but because many people come and speak to me about difficulties that they're facing in their life. And very often they're in the middle of a situation that they say they just don't know how it happened. All of a sudden, something drastic just happened. All of a sudden, my teenager left home. All of a sudden, my marriage broke up. All of a sudden, this or that happened. And very often people will say it as though it's got nothing to do with them. They're completely bamboozled about how it happened. They aren't able to reflect on how the situation that's arising in the present is a continuation of causes and conditions that have been operating in their life up until that time. Some of the factors are not in their control, but many factors are. But they're not factors that just arose right now. They're factors that have been fed by choices, by decisions, by habit patterns, by ways of thinking, by ideas that have been developing and been acted on over the course of years. And if we're going to start to create the kind of life that we want and avoid the kind of situations that bring heartbreak, then we have to start to become aware of those various causes and conditions as they operate in our own life and in our relationships with the people around us. Now, it's not always that these crises arise just because we're selfish and because we're blinkered in a selfish kind of way, just pursuing what we want at the expense of others. It can be that we're pursuing a course of action in our life that we think is beneficial. We've been told it's beneficial, and we just keep at it, even when we can see that it's actually been quite destructive to our own well-being and to the peace and happiness of the people around us. An example of this is when parents work long hours, really put themselves out in their career, thinking that they need to do that in order to accumulate enough money so that they can give their children all the things that are going to make them happy. Now, someone was talking to me recently about how they've been working at a job for years, which they don't like, but they've stuck with it because they were getting the income from it that they needed to provide the kind of lifestyle that their family, they thought, needed in order to be happy. Now, this is a very common scenario. And working for years at a job that you don't like means that there's a lot of dissatisfaction. Dissatisfaction not only when you're at work, but you take it home with you. And as happens, you work very hard at this job you don't like, and nobody appreciates just the effort that you're making to do that job for their benefit. Relationships start to sour, and then it seems even less rewarding to be doing that job, doing it for the benefit of others. As that kind of dissatisfaction turns into resentment, relationships at home sour even further. Until very often conflict arises openly in the family. And these are the kinds of situations that people talk about, that suddenly they're screaming at each other, or suddenly one of their family members is slamming the door and running out and not coming back again. And people say, I just don't know how it got to be like that. And of course, when that kind of thing happens, when families go into crisis, one of the first reactions is to try to blame, to find someone to blame for the problem that's there. Blame ourselves or blame someone in the family. Look for one person who should carry the burden for what's happened, or one situation that made everything go wrong. And of course, if we look to blame, and if we try to blame just one situation even, we'll be just taking a very narrow view of the whole thing. Because in reality, what's happened is that multiple causes and conditions, multiple influences have brought that crisis about. Even with good intention, trying to do the best for one's family, putting oneself through the stress of staying in a job that you don't like. All of these are factors, all of these are causes and conditions. And very often when we find ourselves in a crisis like that, if we can't find someone to blame, or we're not blaming ourselves, if we can't find one simple reason for what's happened, it's very likely that we feel completely confused and lost, almost that we can't do anything, that we just have to put up with what's happened, unless it's something really drastic. Then that shakes us to the point where we can't ignore it, but we try to ignore it for as long as possible. And trying to ignore it means very often that we have to hide our feelings. and then it becomes even more difficult to say how we really feel because we've pushed them down, or they've now got so much force that we don't dare express any negativity because we know it will be a real explosion. And things go on and on. And we don't see how we can change. And even when we get to that kind of situation, it's very unlikely that we will start to question the goal that we were pursuing in the first place. We look for explanations for why it's not working out. We very rarely ask ourselves whether what we were trying to accomplish in the first place is actually for our benefit and is actually going to provide us with what we ultimately want, which is happiness and loving relationships with the people that we care about. So the idea that material prosperity, that success in a career, that being able to buy the things that we think we need is actually going to produce happiness. Very often we don't even stop to question our original goal. We keep trying to rearrange the pieces to produce the result we want, not realizing that not only don't we have the pieces, but we are pursuing something which in itself isn't going to bring us the happiness that we're seeking. Now, in this particular teaching of the Buddha, when we encounter problems, when we encounter a crisis particularly, and we have, first of all, gotten through the blaming and trying to find one particular thing that's made it so bad, this teaching encourages us then to look more widely, to look more deeply, to see what we've been doing in our life, not just right before the crisis, but over the course of our life, with the choices that we've been making, with the way that we've been approaching things, the decisions, the habit patterns of our mind, to see what factors have been contributing to the result that we've got right now. Because if we want the future to be different, we have to produce it through changing the causes that are operating right now. We can't create a new future with the same ingredients. We might wish that we could all get on better, for example, that everyone would be happy in the family or be satisfied with what we've got. But unless we change the ingredients in that mix, we can't produce a different future. So we have to be brave enough to put aside the idea that we can blame another person, or we can blame ourselves, or that we can find one single thing that if we change that, the whole lot will change. We have to be willing to really look, and we might have to look as far back in the past as 15 years ago to see what contributed to where we are today. And we're not looking back in order to blame. We're not looking back in order to feel guilty about things. We're looking back in order to learn, to be able to recognize what gives rise to what. In this particular teaching, the Buddha says, because of this, there is that. Because of that, gives rise to this. things grow dependent on other factors. So we have to start to look at those various factors in order to recognize what has we've been growing in our life. The law of continuity works for our advantage and for our disadvantage. The things that bring happiness, if we make those grow, they produce more happiness. But if we keep growing the things which lead to misery, to conflict, then we will continue to reap unhappiness, even if we wish it to be otherwise. One of the characteristics of life, the Buddha said, is that everything changes. Everything's unstable. And one of the reasons that we don't see this is because of continuity. Because the body looks pretty much the same today as it did yesterday, or our life is pretty much the same today as it was yesterday, we have this wrong understanding that things are permanent, that they'll continue in this way. And so we have these two, not exactly opposites, but two complementary things, this impermanence and instability masked by continuity. Now, when we understand that we're working with both these qualities in our life, we recognize that the impermanence is what makes it possible for us to change, to bring in something new, to rearrange things, to let go of what's not useful. And the continuity means that it's possible to make those things which are helpful, those things which bring happiness, grow in our life. So we're working with both of these things. And when we recognize the usefulness of these qualities of impermanence and continuity, we're getting a much more realistic understanding of what life is about, of what life has to offer to all of us. Ordinarily, when we think about impermanence, we think of it as something that's terrible. Change. Can't hang on to the things as they are right now. Everything's unstable. Got nothing solid to hang on to. But when we recognize that impermanence makes it possible for us to create the kind of life that we want, the fact that the things that we know are harmful, we can start to let go of. We can learn about them. We can change in our relationship to those things. Impermanence becomes an ally, becomes something which supports our growth and development. And the continuity we recognize as something which is a relative concept. The idea that we can't have things always the way that we want them is true. We realize that change is always there as an underlying factor. But we can, through our skillfulness, through our wisdom, start to create the things in our life which will bring us greater understanding, greater peace, greater harmony, all of the things that we would like to have. And because of the continuity, we can start with something that may be fragile, underdeveloped, and if we keep at it, if we keep working at it, we can make those things grow until they become stronger and become dominant characteristics of the way that we approach life, the way we do things, the way we think about things. So these two qualities work together for our benefit. They make it possible for us to redesign our life and to have it develop in the way that we want it to. And especially as we develop more understanding and more wisdom about where our true happiness is to be found, we become more skillful, more able to know which things to develop and which things to let go of. Instead of looking at the things which trigger our difficulties, focusing on just what's given rise to a crisis, we are willing to look much further and much deeper for the causes for our suffering. And when we're willing to do that, then we have a much better capacity for creating the things which will lead to our happiness. So my trip to Sri Lanka was a way of reminding myself of where I've come from, not only reminding myself but being able to rejoice with the people there who'd supported me in my early days. But it was also a very powerful reminder of the fact that whatever we have right here and now always comes from somewhere else. And if we want to continue to make the good qualities in our life grow and to make our understanding of the Dharma grow, that we have to continue to create those conditions for ourselves right here and now, because that is how we will produce the kind of future that we all would like to have. So I encourage all of you to reflect on this teaching on continuity, recognizing that when we put the continuity together with the impermanence, we realize that we actually do have the power to create the kind of life that we would like for ourselves. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of you, and may it help us all to attain Nibbana.